Welcome back to those of you who sat with us, and welcome to those of you who are joining us. The topic I'd like to speak about tonight is called the four thoughts that turn the mind. This particular topic came up for me because I've been reflecting recently upon a statement I heard in the early 70s. When I first got involved with Buddhist practice. And it's a statement that comes up periodically for me that I revisit and spend time contemplating. It was a comment that one of my Buddhist teachers made in which he said, quote, "The way that we really learn the Dharma is by marinating in it," unquote. And I was struck by that comment initially because it seemed quite strange, frankly. And yet, as the years have gone by and I've continued to practice, I feel like I've come increasingly to understand what it was he was talking about. That is to say, that those of us who involve ourselves with practice over an extended period of time, I think inevitably come to revisit certain teachings that we've experienced, either on a personal level or through study. And we come to see that what those teachings mean to us changes over time. Clearly, if it has to do with something we've read, for example, the print in the book has not changed. What has changed is our perceptual vantage point. And the being that we have become, who is increasingly unfolding in an evolutionary manner and perceiving and understanding ourselves and our lives in new and different ways. I was first introduced to this teaching, the four thoughts that turns the mind, when I went to Nepal for an extended period in the late 1980s. I was there from late 86 until just before the year 2000. Primarily, I was there to study with a particular Tibetan teacher named Trangu Rinpoche, a very respected teacher in the Karma Kagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. I was also excited about the possibility of studying with a number of other revered Tibetan teachers who were still alive at that point in time and no longer are, but people like Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and other people of that sort. The four thoughts that turn the mind in Tibetan teachings is what's referred to as the ordinary preliminaries. I realize some of you are probably quite familiar with Tibetan perspective on Buddhist teachings, and others less so or not familiar at all. But the Tibetan tradition generally, in regard to all four major schools, involves a practice that in Tibetan is called the Lam Rim, which translates into English as the graded path. And this particular perspective is one that has many, many steps in it. The first of which is the ordinary preliminaries. That is, those of us who are coming to the teachings as seer practitioners are asked to consider why it is we should practice. What's the motivation that is moving us to engage with these teachings and to take them into our hearts and to invite them to transform us and transform our lives? So essentially, what the four thoughts are is a set of four reflections and contemplations that we're asked to do on a regular basis in a particular phase of practice at the beginning of working with Tibetan teachings. And the four thoughts are these, and I'm going to speak a bit about them this evening, and hopefully you'll see that they apply far beyond the Tibetan approach to Buddhist practice. I'd say that they're quite relevant for any approach to Buddhist practice, and from my perspective, they're really relevant to any authentic contemplative practice designed to open our hearts and quiet our minds and actualize our best human qualities. Now, the first of the four thoughts is the freedoms and advantages of a precious human birth. The second, the truth of impermanence and change. The third reflection, the workings of karma. And the fourth reflection, the suffering of living beings within samsara. I'd like to speak a little bit about each of these, do a guided meditation with you in a bit, and then allow some time for some discussion, conversation, questions if you have any, so that hopefully this can be of some benefit in your life and your practice. Now let's take a look at the first one, the freedoms and advantages of a precious human birth. Classically in Tibet, this was also sometimes said to be a precious rebirth, which for some of us is comfortable and familiar territory. And for others of us, having grown up in a scientific materialistic culture like the one that we live in, this is not something we're accustomed to thinking in terms of, and it may or may not be relevant and useful in our practice at a given point in time. But nonetheless, the very notion that we have the capacity as human beings to make choices is one example of what we're talking about when we talk about the freedoms and advantages of being a human being. I think each of us has experienced in our lives that the choices we make play a significant role in how our lives unfold. Well, that's not to say that we have the illusion of controlling our circumstances and the external events in our lives on a regular basis. However, we do have a lot to say about how we respond to those events. We can choose to do a daily meditation practice, or we can choose to watch a daily game show. It's really up to us. Yeah. And once we recognize that, and we take ownership of that sense of agency and autonomy, there's a certain kind of empowerment that arises in our lives. And we recognize that we can play an active role in shaping the way our lives and our characters unfold over time. Even in terms of modern science, however, the fact that we're even born at all as a human being has a miraculous element to it. The writer Bill Bryson captured this in one of his books. He described our situation as human beings in this way. To be here now, alive in the 21st century, and smart enough to know it, you had to be extremely, make that miraculously, fortunate in your personal ancestry. Consider the fact that for 3.8 billion years, a period of time older than the Earth's mountains and rivers and oceans, every one of your forebears on both sides has been attractive enough to find a mate, healthy enough to reproduce, and sufficiently blessed by fate and circumstances to do so. Not one of your pertinent ancestors was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stranded, stuck fast, untimely wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly in you. So there's a miraculous element here that's easy for us to miss. My friend and mentor, Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who I worked with for a number of years at a conscious aging institute, initially called the Spiritual Eldering Institute, and currently called Saging International, was talking to us one evening, and he paused and had this wonderful look of delight on his face. And he said to us, the real question here is, why is there something instead of nothing? And you could see the wonder in his face, how open he was to the miraculous nature of our existence. Where our meditation training and our mindfulness practice comes into play here is that it cuts through what one novelist called the veil of familiarity that so often covers our eyes. That might be the only line I remember from a freshman English class in college, my first year at Tulane University. And the line was, as she walked down the stairs, her eyes were covered by the veil of familiarity. And how easily that happens to us if we sit across the breakfast table from the same person for year after year, or we work in an office across the hall from the same person year after year, or we walk our golden retriever in the same park on a regular basis. What practice is helping us to do is to come fully alive in the present moment and embrace the mystery and the miracle that each of us is, and that each of our lives actually is as well, right? The poet Ellen Bass, gifted writer whose work I deeply appreciate, captured how powerful an ordinary event can be when we're truly present. Her poem is called Gate C22. At Gate C22 in the Portland airport, a man in a broadband leather hat kissed a woman arriving from Orange County. They kissed and kissed and kissed. Long after the other passengers clicked the handles of their carry-ons and wheeled briskly toward short-term parking, the couple stood there, arms wrapped around each other, like he'd just staggered off the boat at Ellis Island, like she'd been released at last from ICU, snapped out of a coma, survived bone cancer, and made it down from Annapurna in only the clothes she was wearing. Neither of them was young. His beard was gray. She carried a few extra pounds you could imagine her saying she had to lose. But they kissed lavish kisses like the ocean in the early morning, the way it gathers and swells, sucking each rock under, swallowing it again and again. We were all watching, passengers waiting for the delayed flight to San Jose. The flight attendants, the pilots, the aproned woman icing the Cinnabons, the man selling sunglasses. We couldn't look away. We could taste the kisses crushed in our mouths. But the best part was his face. When he drew back and looked at her, his smile soft with wonder, almost as though he were a mother still open from giving birth, as your mother must have looked at you, no matter what happened after. If she beat you or left you or you're lonely now, you once lay there, the vernix not yet wiped away, and someone gazed at you as if you were the first sunrise seen from Earth. The whole wing of the airport hushed, all of us trying to slip into that woman's middle-aged body, her plaid Bermuda shorts, sleeveless blouse, glasses, little gold hoop earrings, tilting our heads up. Very ordinary event happens every day. But there was a way this poet captured it and made it present for us in this moment. Yeah. That's what we're talking about when we talk about the advantages and possibilities of our precious human birth. Rather than living in a world that Tibetans call the hungry ghost realm, always wondering when we're going to get there, whatever there might mean for us, what the practice is teaching us and reminding us to keep central in our lives is the reality that the present moment is the touch point for what's real in our lives at all times. It's so easy to forget. But the first of these reflections on why we practice is so that we can remember what's most important. There's an oft-repeated quote from Suzuki Roshi, the wonderful founder of the San Francisco Zen Center back in the 60s. He said in one of his Dharma talks, quote, "The most important thing is to remember the most important thing." And in this case, it's to show up in our lives and embrace the fact that they can only be experienced fully in the here and now. Yeah. So that's the first of these reflections, the freedoms and advantages of a precious human birth. So we own that we are choice makers, we own that life is precious, and we embrace it fully, including the full rainbow of joys and sorrows that accompany whatever moments of life we experience. Yeah. The second of these reflections and contemplations, the truth of impermanence and change. I suspect very strongly that every single one of us here in the Zoom room intellectually understands this truth. At the same time, I ask myself and each of you, how many of us actually live our lives as if we believe this truth to be true? I remember a number of years ago in a talk that Jack Kornfield gave, he told a story about a woman who had come to see him. It was a sad story. She was the wife of a very beloved physician in Amherst, Massachusetts, who, among other things, had been the doctor of choice for many of the spiritual teachers in the area and people involved in the spiritual communities in Amherst. This man had died suddenly and unexpectedly, and in the aftermath of that tragedy, because he was so beloved, among other reasons, a number of these different spiritual teachers came to speak with and console his wife, who was grieving deeply. What was interesting was that each of them spoke about the situation through the lens of their respective spiritual practice. So there was a contemplative Christian teacher who came and spoke to her and answered some of her questions about why this had happened and what had happened, and basically explained to her that he had had a vision of her husband at the right hand of God. And because he was such a good man and had lived such a meritorious life, he felt that her husband was at peace. And even though we couldn't understand why something like this would happen, she could rest in peace and go through her grief with an understanding that her husband, on some level, was okay. Yeah. A Tibetan Buddhist teacher came, spoke to her with a similar caring in his heart, a very well-intended, and for similar reasons to what the contemplative Christian teacher talked about, suggested to her that her husband would have an auspicious rebirth. Yeah. A Sufi teacher came to speak, and one other, I believe. But eventually, she found her way to Jack. Someone directed her to Jack Kornfield and said he would be helpful for her to talk to. So she reported to Jack these experiences the experiences she'd had with these other teachers. And she then said to him, "And what's your perspective on this situation? What happened with my husband?" Jack thought about it for a moment and he said, "I think you've heard more than enough points of view at this point. I'm not sure that it would be helpful for you to hear yet another perspective from me, from my particular spiritual viewpoint. Let's try a little experiment," he said. He said, "I'd like you to close your eyes if you're comfortable doing so and willing to do so." And he guided her into quieting down, using her breath and going inward for a bit. And when she felt somewhat still and the room became quiet, he said to her, "Well, in the quietness now, I'd like you to reflect upon your own deepest understanding of the situation with your husband. What's the deepest truth, what's the deepest truth that you understand about your husband's death?" And the woman became very quiet and still and sat for a few minutes. And then she opened her eyes and she looked at Jack and she said two words: "Everything changes." And she stopped. And Jack responded by simply saying, "I think that's enough for you to know for now." Now, why this story seems so important to me is because it reminds us of the distinction between what I would call conceptualization and visualization. That is to say, many of us are quite capable of understanding the most profound Buddhist teachings on a conceptual level. What I think a lot of us have come to see is that the process of spiritual maturation involves a movement from conceptual understanding to what the teachings call realization. That is, an integrated knowing that we experience on the level of our bones and our bodies, as well as our minds and our brains. Yeah. And it's this integrated understanding that the practices in Buddhist training and other contemplative traditions are helping us to take into our hearts so that we can gently release the conditioned grasping that causes so much extra and unnecessary suffering in our lives. Right. The Buddha talked about this in the suttas on a regular basis, most classically in the Diamond Sutta, in which he said, quote, "Thus shall we think of all this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream." This is all quite real to me at the moment. I spent last week on solo retreat in central Colorado in a little place called Crestone, in a retreat cabin that was completely off the grid and that had no other physical structures in view. It was at about 9,000 feet and about a quarter mile from a Tibetan stupa in honor of the 16th Karmapa, who I had the good fortune to meet at one point. And I spent that week in profound isolation. Quite amazing. I felt a little bit like I was visiting the moon for the first time, or the canyon lands in Utah. Yeah. But I noticed as I came back to Boulder on Sunday night and plugged back into my regular day-to-day life, how quickly it all vanished. I mean, there were certainly some powerful meditation experiences there, and it was very much what the inner doctor ordered in terms of some rest and some recuperation and relaxation. And at the same time, where is it now? Right? Where is the 25-year-old version of each of us? Where is the sixth grader that was nervous about passing the math test? Right? I mean, it's also ungraspable in a certain way. It's as if our lives are like sand falling through our hands. And as much as the ego is uncomfortable with that, it simply seems to be true. Yeah. And what the teachings are encouraging us to do is to turn toward and embrace that truth in such a way that it becomes a source of liberation, rather than to psychologically defend ourselves against that truth so that it becomes a kind of inner battle that we are struggling with endlessly. Yeah. I think this is one reason why the word surrender shows up so prominently in many spiritual traditions. What's true for me, and I'm sure some of you can relate to this, is that one of the most difficult aspects of change and impermanence to face directly is the truth of death, something that each of us will face when the time comes. I talked to a friend of mine recently who's a physician, both a surgeon and a palliative care physician. And he shared a story with me that really touched me because I used to do a lot of hospice work and directed a hospice down in New Mexico for a while. My friend was talking to a hospice nurse who's a friend of his, and she shared a story with him in which she was talking to a woman who was quite near the end of her life, and they were in a very intimate conversation together about how this woman was feeling about her situation. And the nurse said to this woman, "What is it like for you to know that you're dying?" And the woman smiled at the nurse, and then she said to the nurse, "What is it like for you to pretend that you're not?" Which completely threw the nurse, and I thought was just a brilliant comment. Just brilliant, right? There's a story in ancient India that captured this really well, this tendency toward denial that we all have. There was a sage who had a longtime disciple and student who approached the sage and said at one point, "Teacher, of all the wondrous wonders in this world, what would you say is the most wondrous of all?" I guess this is the version of mirror, mirror on the wall, maybe. And the teacher thought about it for a moment and he said, "The most wondrous wonder in the world is that human beings can live in a world day in and day out, surrounded by people who are dying, and persist in believing it's not going to happen to them." Because even when we intellectually understand it, there's a part of us that simply finds it difficult to take in and difficult to assimilate into our lives as a fundamental fact. Yeah. What practice does in this case, though, is it helps us to do that. I've seen this time and time again when I've worked with practitioners who came to the end of their lives, how their meditation practice and their study of the Dharma and their service activities, which enriched their lives and brought great meaning to their lives, have enabled them to approach the end of their lives with incredible grace in many cases. There was a member of our Sangha here in Boulder named David Mendoza, who was a good friend in certain ways and who I knew for many years. He practiced with our community for about 12 or 13 years after wandering in one day at the Unitarian Church where we were renting space, and he was a member. And every summer for a number of years, I've been teaching a week-long retreat up at Shambhala Mountain Center in the mountains outside of Fort Collins. And that was one of several retreats that David would attend in our area. In the latter part of his life, he became a very committed environmental activist, and among other things, sold his car and depended on other forms of transportation to get places. So every year prior to the week-long retreat, he would contact me and say, "Can you help me get a ride up to the retreat and back?" Which I would do without any problem, really. 4 years ago, he contacted me in that way. And I checked with a few people who I knew were going to the retreat and set him up a ride. So I sent him off an email. I said, "I've got your ride." And he sent me this email back, which he gave me permission to share. "Thank you, David, but my plans have changed. The reason I missed the Sangha on Tuesday evening was because I went to a hospital Thursday morning. A CT scan that morning indicated that I have liver cancer. They then biopsied my liver, and I got the results yesterday afternoon. This cancer, a rare type called angiosarcoma of the liver, is incurable. The prognosis is poor, but I haven't seen an oncologist yet to see what my alternatives are. Surgery is out because it has already so thoroughly invaded the liver. The pain is manageable with morphine pills around the clock. Of course, the diagnosis on Tuesday was a complete surprise, but somehow I was completely prepared for it. And my mood has been completely positive since then, partly because I immediately dropped my most burdensome obligations. In respect to your offering to help me get a ride to your retreat at the Shambhala Mountain Center, I don't expect to still be around when the retreat comes. So that's one less obligation for you. Be well, David." David died about a month after he was diagnosed. I had several warm-hearted conversations with him. A number of people from the Sangha visited with him. And he essentially maintained the outlook that was captured in that email right to the end of his life and perhaps beyond. So my suggestion here is not naive, and it's not Pollyanna-ish in any way, shape, or form. It's simply that there's a certain wisdom in turning toward the reality of impermanence and change, rather than resisting or resenting or disbelieving through denial. And in doing so, allowing the awareness of impermanence and change, like we do with that first of the four thoughts, allowing that awareness to heighten our appreciation for the life we have in the moment when we have it, and to embrace it fully with a quiet sense of celebration for the gift that it is, and ideally to make good use of it in terms of what in Buddhism we would call the Bodhisattva tradition. I don't think there's anything morbid about this idea whatsoever, although it's not uncommon for Buddhist teachings to be misinterpreted in that way. People understand the idea of turning toward death or impermanence as something grim or morbid rather than simply realistic and factual. The well-known writer Terry Tempest Williams commented on this notion of turning toward as something that's not a problem for her. She writes, "A good friend of mine said, 'You are married to sorrow.' And I looked at him and I said, I am not married to sorrow. I just choose not to look away. And I think there is deep beauty in not averting our gaze. No matter how hard it is, no matter how heartbreaking it can be, it is about presence. It is about bearing witness. I used to think bearing witness was a passive act. I don't believe that anymore. I think that when we are present, when we bear witness, when we do not divert our gaze, something is revealed, the very marrow of life. We change. A transformation occurs. Our consciousness shifts. So we have the freedoms and advantages of a precious human birth. We have the truth of impermanence and change. And then we have the workings of karma. Needless to say, this is a very rich and complex topic that whole Dharma talks are done on a regular basis. However, it's also a central teaching in Buddhist tradition across all the different schools. And it's for that reason, I think, that we're asked to contemplate what it means on a regular basis and how contemplating it will influence the way we live and practice the Dharma. If we look at the classical teachings, we find many kinds of karma talked about. The primary ones are called present karma, resultant karma, proximate karma, and weighty karma. Roughly in a nutshell, resultant karma, let's talk about that first. And as the Buddha said on a regular basis, and I think we all understand, we don't have to believe any of this just because it was taught by the Buddha or any other spiritual tradition. The invitation is to take these teachings in and look at our own experience and see if they ring true in our own experience. That's one of the things that attracted me most to the Buddhist tradition when I first encountered it. I never heard, take it on faith. I heard, take a good look at your own experience and see if this rings true in your experience. And if it does, use it. What resultant karma says is that any action, thought, or deed that I commit will bear fruit. Quite simply, what we do on the level of body, speech, and mind matters. If I plant an apple seed, I'll get an apple tree. I won't get a peach tree. What present karma says is that when that resultant karma comes to fruition, how I respond to it determines what happens next. So if I commit a certain action, hypothetically, and it has karmic repercussions that come to fruition in my life, when those repercussions come to fruition, if I respond with mindfulness and compassion, that karma burns out and is completed. If I respond unskillfully with greed, delusion, or aggression, that resultant karma, the present karma that arises, is more resultant karma again, which is what the cycle of samsara involves. That is, resultant karma comes to fruition. If I respond skillfully, it burns out, it's completed. If I respond unskillfully, that response becomes a new seed of resultant karma and keeps us on the wheel, if you will, right? When the teachings talk about what's called proximate karma, the basic idea is, now this is in the context of the rebirth teachings, So whether you're someone who embraces that teaching or is agnostic about it or finds it to be irrelevant or unbelievable, just suspend that for a moment so you can understand the context of the original teachings. Proximate karma said that the thought that we're having in the moment of death plays a significant role in what happens after death, which is a suggestion that it's worth our time and our practice to pay attention to what's in our mind stream on a regular basis, since none of us knows for sure when that moment of death will come. As Joseph Goldstein is fond of saying, with a sort of enigmatic grin, oftentimes, quote, "Anything can happen at any time," unquote. As someone who spent a number of years doing clinical work as a psychotherapist with people who were severely traumatized in various ways, I've come to really see the truth of that statement. Anything can happen at any time. So if we're mindfully paying attention to what's in our mind stream, what comes out of our mouth, and our actions, if and when that moment of death comes, if it's unexpected, it can be a positive influence if it's a thought or an action that's wholesome in Buddhist language. The notion of weighty karma that comes into play here has to do with the fact that in some of our lives, there are actions that are so powerful that when we approach our death, those events will very likely come to mind. The first place I worked with people when I was an undergraduate student was a prison in New Orleans, right? And I could see how some of the crimes people had committed were with them much of their waking day, even years after the crime had been committed. If someone has committed something really horrific, like a murder, right? What the teaching on weighty karma says is that there's a very good chance when the moment of death comes, that that event may enter the person's consciousness. The most relevant aspect of this teaching, though, as a regular reflection, has to do with what I talked about in the first description of the first of the four thoughts, which is that the teaching on karma says that we are making choices and our choices matter. It's very easy to forget that and subtly or not so subtly come to see ourselves as victims, which is problematic, as many of us know, on a lot of levels. There's a story that I heard about His Holiness the Dalai Lama that was very moving to me. At one of the first meetings he had with the Western Dharma teachers, senior Western Dharma teachers, there was a point during one of the Q&A periods where one of the Dharma teachers asked the Dalai Lama an interesting question. He said, "Your Holiness, if there would be one teaching that you had to choose to offer Western Dharma practitioners that you think would be the most important for them to know, what would that teaching be?" The way the story was told to me, the person who told it to me felt that everybody in the room thought that it would be the teaching on emptiness of self, which in many ways is what distinguishes Buddhism from every other contemplative tradition. The Dalai Lama thought about the question, and then his response was, "I would teach them about the law of karma." He said, "That is what empowers people to make positive changes in their lives. The recognition that they can make choices that will have positive effects on their body and consciousness, on those around them, and on the world." So the fact that His Holiness would in fact suggest that that was the single most important teaching to present to Western students suggests to me that it's well worth our time contemplating the teachings on karma. Ram Dass summed it up in a comment that he made, which I found fascinating. Another one of these that I revisit on a regular basis. This is how he shared a comment on karma. This moment has in it a lawful connection to everything that's going to happen and everything that ever did happen. It's not only lawfully connected across space, but across time as well. So that when you are sufficiently quiet and centered, you are in the presence of all of it. That's when Kala Rinpoche says things like, quote, "You are nothing," and realizing you are nothing, you are everything. At that moment, you are past and future and all of it. So let's talk a little bit about the fourth of these reflections, and then we can have hopefully some discussion if you'd like. The suffering of living beings within samsara. Now, why would we want to reflect upon that? Well, for one thing, we are included in living beings. And if we want to understand our own suffering, it's worth our time and energy to be curious and interested in how we experience suffering so that we can also come to see what liberates us from suffering. When we do become curious and turn toward our own suffering with a sense of investigation, as is talked about in the Seven Factors of Awakening, one of the things we discover that's really essential from my perspective is that our own suffering can become a gateway to compassion. That is to say, to the extent that I know the experience of grief and loss, when I'm sitting with someone who is grieving and experiencing a loss, even if the details are different than my own experience, I can show up in a much more authentic manner than if I only understand grief and loss from the neck up, so to speak. What this does for us that's so important is it helps us to turn away from nihilistic and cynical perspectives on suffering and recognize that from a spiritual standpoint, our suffering is functional. It's not desirable. It's not something any of us would choose or hopefully wish on anybody else. But because the First Noble Truth is true, that our lives do involve suffering at certain times, it behooves us to turn toward that suffering with a loving curiosity and to allow it to become something that transforms us into wounded healers, which is another way to talk about the bodhisattva path. The writer Andrew Harvey, a really wonderful British mystic and spiritual scholar, described what I'm trying to say in his words this way. Spiritual life has nothing to do with evading suffering. It has everything to do with opening to the full effects of suffering. And by that wild act of opening to suffering, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of every being around us, by that act, discovering the mystery of the presence in and beyond suffering. This takes courage. This takes an absolute honesty. This takes a ferocious commitment to truth. I think a lot of us have experienced how deep the conditioning is that inclines us to avoid suffering. One of the major challenges When I worked for many years training psychotherapists in the graduate school at Naropa University, involved helping the people who were in the program to extend their affect tolerance. One of the reasons that meditation was required in that program for every participant was that it enabled people to be present to and open their hearts to an increasingly broad range of what the Taoists would call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. Because if I'm going to be present with someone and not turn away when they share their suffering, right, I need to be able to know that I have the capacity to do that, and to be present to my own suffering teaches me to be present for someone else. Several years ago at that Shambhala Mountain retreat that I mentioned that I do every summer, one of the participants left me a note and asked if she could meet with me individually. When we sat down together, she explained to me, and this was a woman in her mid-40s who gave me permission to share her story. She revealed that during the last sit, that she had become aware of an experience of abuse when she was a child. And she, former to that experience in meditation, the previous sitting period, had no earthly idea this was a part of her past, but it came back into her awareness in a very clear manner. She basically wanted to know how to work with it. And so we talked about it, and she started to have dreams about it. And we met intermittently over the course of the retreat so I could help her feel like she was capable of working with what was happening. One of the images in the retreat, and the way it showed up symbolically, was that the perpetrator was a tiger in this dream image that kept coming up. She left me this note on the last morning of the retreat, again, which I'm sharing with her permission. "David, this morning I understood. I didn't need to do anything. I simply needed to behold the tiger. As I did, my point of attention moved to the contact of the chair and my feet. I knew I was supported by all the earth. While I observed the tiger and the constriction in my chest and neck, a child climbed on the back of the tiger. She wrapped her arms around the tiger's neck and sobbed. Soon, there was only the tiger. Then, there was only the child. Then, only the grief and my breath and support. Then, there was only the breath. Thank you." I would say that qualifies as a ferocious commitment to truth. And that kind of healing is something that I've seen on more than this one occasion. So let me keep an eye on the time here. Let me just summarize and review briefly so that we do have some time for discussion. What I'm suggesting here is that the concept of learning the Dharma through marination has a certain truth and relevance to it. Oftentimes, we're exposed to the same or similar teachings time and time again. Rather than seeing that as a problem or something to be bored by, I think it's helpful to recognize that that process can become a mirror that reflects back to us the kinds of internal changes we're going through as our understandings of the same teachings unfold in a new and different manner. I chose this particular teaching as an example, the four thoughts that turn the mind, which I first experienced in January of 1987 and have been returning to since. And then we looked at the four thoughts together. The first being the freedom, the freedoms and advantages of a precious human birth, including the miracle and the mystery that it actually is when we have the eyes to see it, and the way in which it's a gift, even when it has challenges and difficulties inherent within it. The truth of impermanence and change, which I suggested we all intellectually understand, but that practice invites us to increasingly integrate and take into our hearts and our bodies on a deeper and deeper level, in such a way that it releases the deeply held tendencies of mind to grasp and hold what fundamentally cannot be held. The third being the workings of karma. And I pointed out the fact that, among other issues, His Holiness the Dalai Lama suggested that that would be the single most important teaching for Western practitioners to understand, because it empowers us and reminds us that we're choice makers and not victims. Not to say that there aren't circumstances that are unfair and that there aren't situations in which there are legitimate victimizations occurring. Rather, that it doesn't help us in dealing with our circumstance to have being a victim become an identity, essentially. And the last of these contemplations, the suffering of living beings within samsara, this is a reminder that the suffering that we experience in our own lives can be understood to be a curriculum for transforming us into wounded healers who understand our lives to be a path of bodhisattva activity. There's a certain possibility that we recognize that there can be meaning and value in some of the suffering we experience, as much as we would not want it to be the case that we experience it. I'll close with a few words of Jack Kornfield's that I think just sum it up, especially this last notion of making choices. He writes, "Whatever your difficulties, a devastated heart, financial loss, feeling assaulted by the conflicts around you, or a seemingly hopeless illness, you can always remember that you are free in every moment to set the compass of your heart to your highest intentions. In fact, the two things that you are always free to do, despite your circumstances, are to be present and to be willing to love." So let me just stop here. If you want to just come into a comfortable position, just briefly, a meditative posture that allows you to reconnect with your sense of presence and alertness. You can let go of the words and concepts that you've just heard and recognize that those that are relevant and of value to you will be available to you when you want or need them. And as we did at the beginning of our time together, let's settle back into the moment once again and experience who we are and what we are at this moment, with a sense of letting be that Sam was talking about. A willingness to embrace whatever we're feeling, thinking, and sensing as we sit here together. Let's take a moment to touch a place of gratitude to the extent that we're able for the opportunity to come together this way and to have such favorable circumstances for meeting and working with spiritual teachings that have the genuine capacity to transform our lives in beautifully positive ways. And I'll close our time together with the words of Thich Nhat Hanh. Studying the teachings, practicing the way of awareness, gives rise to benefits without limit. We vow to share the fruits with all beings. We vow to offer tribute to parents, teachers, friends, and numerous beings who give guidance and support along the path. May it be so. Thank you very much for your kind attention.